And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Steve A. is going to share his experience and strength of hope. 32 years of sobriety, his home group, Skyland Group. We see him frequently, if not every day, here at the Bridge Builder, the 11 o'clock meeting. He's very involved, chairs a lot of meetings. He's from an AA family. His wife, Jennifer, has told her story here. We're just so darn glad to have him. I hope everybody will join me in welcoming and giving a big hand.
Let's see if I can keep it in good enough taste so you still clap for me when I'm done. Of course, you may be clapping when I'm done. Please, get off of there. I'd like to thank Tim for inviting me to speak. At first, I was honored. He said it was his birthday. And I went, wow, he's asking me to speak at his birthday. And then I got to thinking that what he really wanted was donuts at his birthday. That's the reason he invited me over here. But
Did I introduce myself?
My name is Steve, and I'm an alcoholic. That's good, because it reminds me every day who I am and what I am and what I'm trying to do one day at a time. My sobriety date is January 4th, 1982. I didn't plan to live this long. If I'd known I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself. My dad died when I was 8. My brother died at the same age when he was 43 as well. So I was kind of expecting to kick the bucket at age 43. So just be careful. If you plan on croaking early and you get sober, you're going to live longer than you think you're actually going to live. You know, and I guess that takes it at least takes out car wrecks and, you know, getting beat up in a drunken haze and that kind of stuff. And my story is my story, and the big book tells me that what I'm supposed to say is what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. It's not what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. What it was like was it was bad. What happened was it got worse until I couldn't take it anymore, and now it's all better. And then I could sit down, but that's not it. It's a little bit more complicated than that. I'm a little bit more complicated than that. I think that I was destined to be an alcoholic. From the time that I was a wee bitty baby, I was weird, and I guess they would have given me some kind of pills to calm me down, but they didn't have that back then, so they had to just put up with obnoxious me. My fourth grade teacher made me get up in front of the class and read the definition of obnoxious. So I've tried to live up to it ever since. But what I'm going to share with you tonight is my experience, strength, and hope. It doesn't represent, you know, if I'm the only look at an AA book that you get, or, you know, a chapter of AA that you see, please go get another edition, because everybody has a place here. And one of the things I'm really grateful for and really, really proud to do is to tell my story at Tim's birthday. Tim does a lot of work. Tim gets all the speakers for this meeting. He does all the work beforehand along with his compatriots, and really has put a lot into this meeting and continue to get it to grow. And I'm really grateful in AA that we can each find our place to be, you know. I sit around sometimes in meetings going, what in the hell am I doing here? You know, I look at somebody like Debbie that works so hard with this clubhouse and works with so many people. And Tim has found his place with this meeting. And other people are great sponsors. And other people, you know, do all sorts of service work. My wife's best friend is the delegate that just came off. You know, I mean, that's a four-year commitment to AA. And I just can't imagine going down to Macon for 4 years. It's so dreary to me. But the fact is that everybody in here has a place. My first sponsor used to say, you know, I have a seat in AA. You know, that's my chair. And I remember one time going around looking at the back of the chair, seeing if it had his name on it. But he was speaking figuratively, of course, but he has a chair. He has a place. I have a place in this. And everyone in this room has a place in here. And everyone in here has a way of giving back. Once they get, they can give back. And my sponsor impressed upon me the importance of service work. I got out of treatment on Thursday morning, and Thursday night I was working at a registration booth at a convention. And that's a little bit ahead of the game. I grew up here in Atlanta. My family dates back to the 1840s here in Atlanta. My great-great-granddaddy was a mayor of Atlanta in the 1870s, state treasurer in 1880, and to tell a family secret, was impeached for embezzlement in 1881. We at one time had the biggest house, not us, but them, had the biggest house in Atlanta. There's a Angier Avenue down by Masquerade and down in the old Fourth Ward and Angier Place. And, you know, I grew up thinking that me and my family were all that. You know, that we were like, you know, the creme de la creme and all this arrogance and conceit. Even before I knew what arrogance and conceit was, I thought I was better than everybody else. You know, and I knew I was different than everybody else. I started seeing a psychologist when I was 3 years old because I didn't speak. And the fact was that I didn't have to. I was spoiled rotten. My first words were a complete sentence. Where's mine? And you know what? If that doesn't fit the alcoholic personality, where's mine? And more. I want more. And that's the way I went through life. It's, you know, as I said, my dad died when I was young, so I went from going to a Catholic elementary school, and by the time I got to first grade, I could read and write, add, subtract, multiply, and divide. I was so smart, I was so cute, I was so this and so that, and I had sisters that were 8, 10, and 12 years older than me, and there were half a dozen other girls in the neighborhood. They didn't need dolls, they played with me, so every day they come home from school and play with me. So I was just a spoiled, little, entitled little brat, and just waiting for a drink to make it all right. And I always, you know, being so young and away from everybody else in the family, I was always different. I always felt like I didn't fit in. I think that's the overriding sense for me, is that I didn't fit in. I couldn't fit in. I couldn't make myself right, no matter what I did. I tried to be smart and good, made good grades. That didn't work. I tried to be a smart aleck in school and flunk. That didn't work. Finally, my mother, at her wit's end, sent me to a all-boys military school here in North Atlanta, or at least it was all-boys military Catholic school then, to try to get me straightened out. And, you know, I did okay for a while, but then after a while, since my dad had died, we were kind of lived a, you know, lower middle class existence. And, you know, my mother had to learn how to do shorthand to be a secretary. She had two jobs. She had to raise 5 kids by herself. And I don't know how she did it, but she did it. And the only thing I could do was be spoiled and say, you know, she worked two jobs down at Sears and then didn't have enough money to buy me the kind of drum that I wanted, so I threw a fit. You know, I mean, just a spoiled little brat and never enough, never enough, never enough. And so as a result, I grew up pretty lonely, all by myself. We had a bunch of woods behind me, and I'd play all summer there and spend all summer. And at Marist, I did pretty good for a while, but then after a while, I didn't do so well. There was a real kind of class thing going on there, and I'm sitting there waiting for the bus to go home, and the kids are driving home in their 63 Vets and their 66, you know, GTOs, and, you know, I'm waiting for the bus. I was waiting, really, for that first drink to come along. And my story is a typical story of somebody who lived in the late 60s and early 70s. My story includes other forms of alcohol. Powdered alcohol, grassy alcohol, you know, stuff that you could ingest, any kind of stuff you could ingest, I was ready for. A buddy of mine that we grew up kind of get together came back and said, hey, man, you know, I got this, you know, for you. And I tried some of this Blonde Lebanese alcohol. And I remember specifically it was down in a place called Garden Hills, and I was walking, and I was normal, and then I took another step, and suddenly I was all right. My first year in sobriety, there was a speaker from the GSO, and she said that the difference between alcoholics and non-alcoholics is that a non-alcoholic has a drink or two, starts feeling the liquor, and goes, whoa, this feels weird, I'd better stop. They're the freaks that you see at parties that nurse the same drink all night long, you know, that has water coming off the edges of it, you know, that leave it half empty or half, it's half empty to me, it's half full to them, you know. But what she said was is that what happens is that an alcoholic has a couple of drinks, feels the liquor, and goes, yes, this feels right. This is how it's supposed to feel. And me, what I said is, well, if two drinks feel this good, then four drinks are going to feel that much better. And then eight drinks are going to feel that much better. And then blackout, getting sick, waking up in the morning with a hangover. That was my way that I drank. My first time that I actually took a drink was there was about 30 of us high school kids that had a party at a hotel over off of Roswell Road that got busted. We called ourselves the Squire N30, like we were some kind of radicals. So we got busted. We hired this lawyer. We threw in $50 and got off. And that night, I got drunk for the very first time. It was Sterling Big Mouth. And it was nasty, but I drank all six of them, and I blacked out. I got sick, and I had a hangover the next day. And that's the way that I drank from then on. At first, you kind of do it on weekends, and then it becomes more and more of a problem. I went from Marist to went to Chamblee for 6 months, became the biggest dealer of various and sundry alcohols over there, flunked out, went to Open Campus for 6 months, didn't do anything, flunked out, and then I took the GED. So I had a high school degree without really working at it, but at the same time, I was kind of fumbling my way up through school. And at the time, it was kind of the late 70s. The 60s kind of hit late here in the South. There weren't very many real long-haired hippies in the 60s. So I was when I was at Chamblee, we were actually the minority back then, having long hair and being dopers. The jocks, there was the jocks, there were the straight people, and then there were the hippies. And I took the bait. I mean, I thought that, man, we were going to change the world. We were going to grow our hair long. Everything was going to be peace out. We were going to love each other, and we were going to change the world and end the war, and there was going to be no more war, and life was going to be great. And I bought into it. And back then, the Strip was down in downtown Atlanta between 10th Street and 14th Street. There were a lot of head shops down there, and that's where you went to go score. 1970 was my first concert, Steppenwolf, at the old Municipal Auditorium. During that time, I saw some great shows there. I saw The Who in 71 on The Who's Next Tour. I mean, for me to sit here and say, that's another misquote that I hear all the time. I said, man, I wouldn't trade my best. My worst day sober is better than my best day drinking. And I'm going, that's not the quote. That's not the quote. Because I had some awfully good times. The quote is that I wouldn't trade my worst day sober for my best day drinking. And the reason I feel that way is because after the good times came the hangovers and the blackouts and the getting arrested and the troubles with people. And after going to a boys' military school, I mean, I was just ready for something to hit me and make me feel normal. You know, make me, just like that woman said, have a couple drinks and, this feels like it should feel. And alcohol hit that spot. And it says in the doctor's opinion, we drink because we like the effect produced by alcohol. You know, and to deny that is to deny the power of alcohol, and otherwise we'd ever relapse. You know, I mean, if there wasn't some kind of memory in us somewhere along the line that, hey, that worked or that was good, we wouldn't relapse. And So I fumbled my way into college, had a warrant for me down at Carrollton, so I took off to Colorado, did pretty good the first quarter, had like a 3-point-something GPA. The next quarter, I had a 0.54 GPA. So I said, well, they don't want me anymore around here, so I better come home and go to Georgia. That was when you could get into Georgia and be a goofball. I went later to a much later to a law school information kind of forum, and the guy was saying, yeah, you know, something happened around the middle 70s at the University of Georgia. It just became a real party school, and that was about when I was there. I went to the University of Georgia for a whole year and didn't get a single college credit. I wasn't a football player. Back then, you could do that and be a football player. I wasn't a football player. I majored in beer drinking and foosball playing and girl chasing and poker playing and passing out. And it was down there that I really hit my stride as a drinker. Well, I mean, as an amateur drinker, to tell you the truth. One time I woke up in my dorm room, and I had like a bruise on my head. I mean, every alcoholic has that. You wake up with a bruise, a terrible hangover, you know, bruises on my elbows and bruises on my knees. I'm going, what happened? And so, you know how it is with a blackout. You got to ask other people, what happened to you? You know, clear me in, you know. Do I owe you an apology for something? You know, no. We just found you in the bathroom stall, face down, off the commode. So apparently what had happened was I was sitting there and just kind of hit my head, and you know, that's where they found me. Another episode down at the University of Georgia made me realize that I was not a normal. Well, a couple more things. One of them was that somebody had bought a bottle of nitrous oxide alcohol, and nitrous oxide, by the way, if you open it up, it gets so cold that your lips freeze to it. Your lips freeze. And so I said, I don't want you to disconnect me. So my lips froze on me, and they kept it on until I actually fell over, finally, after about 5 minutes. I think I was smart before then. I don't think I'm smart now. I'm sure a few million brain cells, billion brain cells went by the wayside. Another episode down there, I was... And it just is so typical of how I drink and why I know I'm an alcoholic today, is that I everybody has keg parties. Every university has keg parties. And my MO at keg parties was to never leave the kitchen, because there was always a line to get to the keg. And by the time I would get to the front of the line, fill it up, and then I'd go get back in line, because by the time I got back to the front of the line, my glass was half empty. It wasn't half full. It was half empty and needed to be topped off again. And so I'm sitting there doing that, making a few rounds, just getting late. I go outside, and I'm so swirly, so sick, that I throw up. Nothing unusual about that. But what happened was, as I got up off my knees, came back inside the party, got back in line, and filled my beer up again. You know, normal people don't drink like that. I'm sorry. You know, in Esquire magazine or GQ, you know, how to drink like a man. That's not in there. You know, and me being a suave de boner kind of, you know, urban kind of guy, thinking that I'm better than everybody else. It's kind of hard to admit it when you're talking to a girl and you got puke in your hair. I mean, it kind of, you know, you kind of lose your chance there. So finally, about halfway my third quarter there, they kind of came to me and went, Steve, are you in school here? And I go, well, yeah, I'm registered. I paid for my dorm. I said, well, did you go to class? And I went, no. And they said, well, you got to go. And I went, man, you know, I was just getting good at foosball. And so I had to leave. And looking back on it now, with the kind of symptoms that I had for alcoholism, I could have come into AA right then. I was about 20 years old, but I hadn't had enough yet. I came back in, stayed with a friend for a while, and then I moved back in with Mommy. which is kind of humbling for a superior type of person that I am. Moved back in, went to a technical school, Control Data Institute, used to be in Buckhead there. This was back in 1975, 76. Got up every morning at 7 o'clock, you know. And it's alcoholics sometimes can pick themselves up off of their, you know, off of their knees, in my case, you know, and make something temporary. You know, if they have if I had a goal and I could reach that goal, I needed a job since they didn't like me in school anymore, and I needed to support myself. So I picked myself up off the ground and did something for about 6 months. And it worked out. I did well in that school, got a job with a national company, was a real young trainee for them, and became one of their little budding stars, and they didn't treat me right, so I went to another company. And as soon as I went to this other company, I realized I knew I was in the right place, because I was late. I was late for work the very first day, Monday morning. You know how it is. God, late for work. It's 8:35. Late for work, and I get there, and there's nobody there. The receptionist shows up about 9:10. My boss shows up about 9:45, you know, and then he says, all right, well, you know how you're doing, shows me around and says, okay, time to go to lunch at Copperfields. And they go down and they drink all day, you know, and so they have about a 2-hour lunch break at Copperfields, you know, with a liquid lunch. And I said, man, this is the place to be right here. These are my kind of peeps, you know, and I proceeded to drink as heavily as I could. That was the period where I hit my bottom for those 2 years. I used to pay the rent at a place called Aunt Charlie's in Buckhead. Across the street was a bar named Billy's, and its motto was the place to be seen. Aunt Charlie's was across the street, and it was the place not to be seen. And it was a kind of a neighborhood pub. Everybody knew everybody. But my drinking had progressed to such a point. I mean, I had a company car, I had an expense account, I had a nice place. You know, I mean, on the outside, things were going well. But what was happening was that alcohol was not working for me. You know, the alcohol just wasn't doing the trick for me. It wasn't taking me where I needed to go. It wasn't feeling that hole of loneliness that Clancy talks about sometimes, you know. I mean, every alcoholic knows the ease and comfort that comes at once from a drink. And I used to think, that's asking somebody to relapse, because I remember that. You know, that hole back in there and the way that alcohol used to get it and just coat it and make everything all right. It wasn't doing that. And I'm sitting there at this bar with supposedly all the friends that I know, and I'm at the end of the bar, drinking as much as I could drink, you know, doing all the powdery alcohol that I can do and smoking all the leafy stuff I can do, and I'm just not getting there. That loneliness just won't leave. And loneliness won't go away. A friend of mine, mother, has a picture of me from a party from about that same time, and I'm sitting there with a beer in one hand and a brandy snifter with cognac in the other, cigarette in one finger, leafy alcohol in the other, and no doubt white powdery alcohol up my nose. And I'm just looking at that picture going, you know, I don't remember that time, but I remember chasing it as hard as I could and not being able to get there anymore. It just wasn't working. It just wasn't working. And my bottom came on New Year's Eve, 1981, New Year's morning, 1982. And it wasn't. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never heard of. To me, part of my story was that I never ever tried to stop drinking. I never drinking. That was never even part of the solution. It was never even. I never even thought about it. You know, I mean, it was just part of my life. It's what I did, and I didn't think it was a problem, even though I'd had a few DUIs or a DUI and other arrests. You know, it just didn't seem like that was the problem. As a matter of fact, it wasn't that I tried to stop and couldn't stop. It's that I needed to drink and couldn't drink enough. I mean, there literally was not enough alcohol in that bar for me to get where I needed to get. And so I'm sitting there at this New Year's Eve party, And you know how the cycle of parties go, that you know, you get there and they're kind of bland and they build up to a crescendo and then they start weighing down. You know, most people leave when they're kind of up here or starting down. You know, I'm there to the bitter end. I'm still trying to get there. And I remember this, you know, we'd say in a general way what we were like. I'm sitting there just thinking, there's got to be more to life than this, you know? I mean, I really want to kill myself, you know, but I'm too damn scared. And I think that that's the wave that I rode in on to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was just depressed and I was despairing. I was depressed because my life sucked, and I was despairing because I could never see that it was going to change. I was always going to be the unhappy drunk at the end of the bar that they either had to call a cab or take somebody home, or else he drove himself home and drove off a bridge or into a bridge or killed somebody. And that could have been me many times. Many, many times I came home from that bar wondering, you know, how I got home. One morning, I remember I had a cassette tape in there, and I was sitting there, and I used to come home drunk and listen to the music, but apparently I passed out in the car, and about 7 o'clock in the morning, I hear this, mister, you know, and the music's still blaring, and these little school kids are looking in their face at me going, it's time to go to work. And I went, work? Oh, hell no. You know, I'm going to go call in. You know, and drinking had become, instead of the solution, it had become the problem. It had stopped being the solution. And I'd known this friend of mine, Eddie Stubbs, who went to, I got a great Eddie Stubbs story. Scott Holzclaw, whose father was, he was either Section Woods or Shambly. He was the principal. So when you're a principal's kid, you're screwed up anyway. And Eddie Stubbs ended up being an Elvis impersonator out in Vegas. And David Penholster's dad, his dad was the coach out at Oglethorpe. Anyway, they're up. This has nothing to do with anything, but it's a great story. And it's a great stoner story. Because Crow's being pulled, and he's doing like this. And Eddie Stubbs and Penholster are down like this, smoking leafy alcohol. And so they're down like this, and they look back, and Crow's doing like this. Doing like this. Scott's doing like this. And they go, what do you think he wants? I think he wants to go faster, man. So they push all the gas on the car, on the boat. And he just lets it go as they run up on an island in Lake Lanier. You know? Oh, it's just a great stoner story, you know, of how idiots we were. And I don't know how we survived some of the stupid things we did. His dad was the doctor at GM, and so in his truck he used to have some liquid alcohol in little pills, in little bottles. And one day we drank a bottle of lidocaine just to see what would happen. Yeah, I know. I said I was smart. Nobody else said I was smart. So we started to drink it, you know, and we started going, you getting off? No. But my stomach's getting numb. Turned out later we could have died. You know, it could have stopped the whole digestion thing. But, you know, and when we were down on the strip, you know, you'd find pills and you go, hey, pills, man. Let's go take them home. And you take them home and, you know, sometimes they were vitamin B12 and then other times they were something else. And, you know, you take them. What the hell? I'm young. I'm not going to die. Some of us have. Back to Eddie Stubbs. So I knew that Eddie Stubbs had gone to Peaceford because he was depressed and he was going to kill himself. So I said, you know what, that's kind of me. I need to go there. And so I went in there on January 3rd at night. I stopped by a Mexican place and had a beer. That was my last drink, was a beer with my Mexican food on my way to treatment. Drove myself to treatment. And when I got there, they did all the tests and things, and they said, you know what, you know, you might want to think about you know, just for now, not drinking and doing other kinds of alcohol. I said, well, why? Why would I? You know, that was always it. And I'm so grateful that I was able to go into treatment. I really admire those of you who come off the streets into AA and can get sober and stay sober. That was my last drink, that Mexican restaurant on January 3rd, 1982. I would not be sober if I hadn't been in a treatment center, because I would have come in here and I would have seen all you people laughing and having a good time, and me being better than you would have walked out the door thinking that you aren't my kind of people. But I was in treatment behind a locked door. One of the stories there of this guy, one of my favorite stories, is this guy from up in North Georgia Mountains. And his family kept telling him he had a drinking problem. He said, I ain't got no drinking problem, you know. And so his family said, well, and his family told him that they knew where a moonshiner was on Sunday. So they drove him down to Peachford. And they said, he said, where's that liquor? And they said, right behind that door. He got sober and stayed sober. God bless his soul. You know, we get here however we get here. You know, and I like the phrase that we don't get here because we see the light. We get here because we feel the heat. And that heat can come from a spouse. It can come from a job. It can come from living on the street. It can come from the kind of mental and physical torture that I was giving myself to. Because what killed me were the hangovers. The hangovers just absolutely killed me. And I didn't know about alcoholism. I had no idea about AA. Now that I'm in advanced training of AA, I know now if I have a hangover, that what I should do is drink. But back then, I had no idea. Whenever the smell of alcohol, well, usually it was beer with cigarette butts in it the next morning, but I couldn't get near it. I mean, it wasn't, I never even thought about it. So I was in treatment. Some people are sicker than others. I was in a 28-day program for 54 days, and I needed every single day of it. I went from got to remember the first meetings that I went to there. They were all sorts of, I was 26. I thought my life was over, but I damn sure didn't want, you know, you to help me at all. But when I went to the meetings, you people were laughing and smiling and having a good time. And, I wanted kind of what you had, but I wasn't really ready to make a commitment. You know what I'm saying? And you scared me. And I was afraid it was a cult. You know, I was afraid I was going to be, you know, selling flowers down at the airport saying we love you. You know, I really was. I thought I was going to be in a cult. And I thought that if I did that, my life was going to be over. And then they gave me a big book, and I remember sitting there reading through it. And as a recovering ex-Catholic, I saw that word, higher power. Oh, power greater than myself. Uh-oh. And then I saw, oops, God. I didn't see the as we stunned and stood him, but I saw the God part. And me and the God of my growing up had long since parted company. You know, we were no longer in the same area code. We weren't in the same state. As a matter of fact, the people who were Christians that used to try to convert me would soon run the other way, because I would convince them that actually the devil is God. So, and I was actually pretty well convinced that the devil is God, to tell you the truth. So I had so much work to do. But I remember being at a meeting, and Melanie and Bill S., when they got up to these, they had podium participation meetings where you didn't just sit in your chair and talk, you got up in front of everybody. And I was in, you know, I was starting to feel the withdrawal from the alcohol and the other stuff. And I was realizing that, you know, it was becoming real clear to me that my way was not working, that I had to do something. And then what I began to hear was not superficially looking at them and saying how I'm different from them, but they shared what was their strength and spirit, experience and hope, and how much I started to be like them. And it talks about it in the very first part of the big book, you know, about the young people, that maybe you'll come and scoff, but then maybe you'll hear something. You know, maybe you'll say, wow, I used to do that. And then maybe you'll go, wow, I used to feel like that. And then maybe you'll go, wow, maybe this will work for me too. And that was kind of my progression while I was there. You know, and if I hadn't been there, I'd have bolted. I'd have bolted, and I'd have died a sad, lonely death. But I was there. The treatment center I was at required that I work a fifth step by the time before I got out. So at least I was able to do that. I asked Elliot to be my sponsor, the guy who had his name on a chair. And Elliot believed in service work. He believed wholeheartedly in service work. He was always there. He was part of the service structure. He was part of the doing conferences and everything else. And so as a result, I did that. When I got, when I got out on Tuesday morning, Tuesday night, I was dressed like this for an NA convention. So everybody else is dressed like you, nothing wrong, but casual. And I'm dressed like, you know, Johnny Little Preppy Boy, you know, ready to take your registration, sir. I'm surprised they didn't, you know, they had such forbearance to allow me to be, you guys, you must really love AA, you know, to allow me to be a member, you know. I'm such a jerk and I'm such a twit, and you people allow me to be who I am. And one of the things I was once I committed, I jumped in wholeheartedly. And what helped make the switch for me was Rick, one of the counselors, talked about alcohol. And what he said was that alcoholics of our class, the only people who have blackouts are alcoholics. Only alcoholics have blackouts. Normal drinkers do not have blackouts. And so mentally, the click happened. I must be an alcoholic. That must be what's wrong with me. You know, now I can go on and get with what the program is. And since that time, I haven't had a compulsion or a thought about drinking. Because what happened, when that click happened in my little mind, what happened was is that it stopped being the solution. You know, it just stopped being, it hadn't been the solution for 2 years, but I had chased it. But once I realized that happened, that I was an alcoholic, and that's what alcohol did to me, I realized that it was no longer the solution to my problems. Because I'd proved it while I was drinking, and now I knew it, now that I was sober. So I was able to make the click on the first step. I was able to find myself a seat, just like you said, you know, I had a seat in AA. I love the second and the third step because they were so hard for me. Coming from being an ex-Catholic, you know, schoolboy, to somebody that actually had such a genuine antipathy towards the idea of religion and God, to somebody who could, you know, think about turning my will and my life over to the care of God. And I had such a hard time with that. And I did a lot of work on Came to Believe. There's a pamphlet called Came to Believe that's terrific. To the Agnostics really made a big deal for me on the second step. Because I was able, when I read that first part, to live a life based on spiritual principles or to die an alcoholic death are not easy alternatives to face. And they aren't, you know, to sit there and say, well, I've either got to do this or, click, I'm an alcoholic and I'm going to die a certain alcoholic death. But there, some of you are old enough to remember a comedian by the name of Jack Benny. Jack Benny, one of his spiels was he was cheap, very, very cheap. He squeaked. He was so cheap, he squeaked. And one of his little skits was he was in a back alley. And somebody put a gun in his back and said, your money or your life. And there was dead silence. And the crook goes, well, he goes, I'm thinking, you know. And that was the same kind of, I'm thinking I had to do. I knew I was an alcoholic. Spiritual principles? I don't know about that stuff. I really don't know about that stuff. I know. No. Let me think about it some more. And finally, being in treatment and having to do the work and sitting through it, I was able to realize, especially the 12 and 12 is really great when it comes to the second and third step. Because what I found was is that I thought that it was had to be this real narrow hole that I had to jump through. You know, like I said, I thought I was going to be selling flowers, you know, somewhere, you know, down on the corner downtown or preaching or standing on top of something. And it isn't like that at all. All I had to do was believe that there was something there that could restore me to sanity. And then I could go on to work to the third step. And the third step is just be willing to let somebody else run the show. This is all my opinion. This is not AA dogma or anything. I'm really grateful for no AA dogma. They'll never have a As Steve Sees It book. This is my experience, strength, and hope. But once I was able to open the door and realizing that there was some kind of hope for sanity for me, I was able to very simply back then realize that AA, the rest of the steps and the program, was the hope, was me turning my will over to life, over the care of AA and my sponsor. I was so willing back then. I sure wish I had that willingness today. You know, I would go downtown and stand on my head and spit quarters, you know, out of my butt if that's what he wanted me to do. I wanted this program so bad. I wanted to stop hurting so bad that I was willing to do whatever it took. And what was willing, to me, the key is that once you do the fourth step, once you do the third step, how you know you work the third step is that you pick up a pen and begin writing the fourth step. And poor Elliot, he had to, I don't know how he stayed awake. He had to listen to like a 34-page history of Steve Angier, you know, which you can imagine up to age 26 was really meaty. I don't know how he stayed awake. It was like 3 or 4 or 5 hours, you know, and long. And then in third grade, she said this, and then I said this, and then I got in trouble. I hate that principal, you know. God. So I don't know how he stayed awake, but he did. One of the greatest things that Elliot did for me when I did that fourth step was he said, look, I'm going to go to the bathroom, and I want you to write the three secrets that you're going to go to your grave with, and then I want you to write 10 things, 10 assets, 10 good things about yourself. Three things that you left off that you weren't going to tell me, you weren't going to tell anybody, the three things. And then write down 10 things. I only got to 8. But I got rid of that deep down stuff, the deep down shameful things, the things that, you know, I knew as a former Catholic that I was going to hell with, and that it was an express ticket. I knew that, and I got it off. I got it out at least. You know, I don't know about, you know, any kind of, you know, revelatory kind of experience, but at least it wasn't there. And the 8 things that I wrote good about myself, I kind of took out of that and realizing that I wasn't a complete total turd like I thought I was. You know, just complete yak squeeze. I wasn't that. I was, you know, what I was just a stupid, goofy, you know, 26, 27-year-old kid. At the time, I thought I was like the worst person in the world, and at the same time, thinking that I was better than everybody else. It's hard to balance that act. It really is. Or at least it was difficult for me. The other thing I took away, and Harry talked about it on Monday, is that today? That's today. The fifth step. We did the fifth step today. And what the other thing we took about was I felt like I was a member of AA. I felt like I'd actually done something to deserve to be here. You know what? That I had taken some action, and I had begun. I didn't have what you had, but I had begun to do what you did. The sixth and seventh step, you know, then was a breeze. I mean, it's once you do a fourth step and a fifth step, it's like you've got this big pile of garbage, and you're just, I mean, God is like some kind of celestial sanitation engineer, you know? And you go, here, take it away. You know, I don't want to be the same person. I don't want to drink again. Here. And you take it away. And I think that's the reason why it's only 2 paragraphs in the big book, is because it's real intuitive, you know? When you do all this stuff and find out all this stuff about yourself, then you want to go, here, God, help me, take it away, make, you know, do the 7-step prayer, make me instrument your will. will, kind of thing. And that was real easy. The eighth step was so tough for me. Elliot made it easier, the eighth and the ninth step, because I peeked ahead. I'm the kind of person that sometimes reads ahead in the book to find out what's happening. And Elliot said, no, it's a separate step. All we're doing is making a list. So I made the list, and we went through it, and then I proceeded to ignore making the amends for most of the amends. The family stuff I did, but the rest of them, you know what, I'm just not ready for them yet. So I'm not recommending that as a course. I'm just telling what I did. 10th step was easy for me because I screwed up a lot, you know, and I really thought back then that what the 10th step was saying I'm sorry. Saying I'm sorry, you know, I screwed up, I'm sorry, I screwed up, I'm sorry, I screwed up, I'm sorry. And 11 was, you know, okay, I'm trying to get closer to this God I don't know anything about. Okay, we'll kind of worry about that later. And then do the 12th step. And I did a lot of the 12th step, a lot of service work, thinking that that was the cure. You know, Elliot believed in service work. I did a lot of service work. The first kid I sponsored, I had like 4 months, and the kid got out on Sunday morning and got drunk on Sunday evening. And I felt like such a putz, you know, like such a loser. And Elliot looked at me and said, "Well, you stayed sober, didn't you?" I went, "Yeah." He goes, "Then it was a successful 12 step." You know, and I have to remember and keep telling myself that the reason I do the things I do is for me to stay sober, not for you to stay sober. And it's still a difficult thing, especially when I sponsor people, because I want so much the program to work for people, and at the same time, I want so much that I end up wanting too much, you know, and telling you how to do things. And that's not how I think it's supposed to be done. And I'm trying to do better with that. We'll see. As I went along, I had a kind of a rut that I fell into. You know, alcoholics get in a rut, they move in and decorate it. And I had decorated this rut. I dated this girl that I had 6 months. She had gotten a year, so it was okay for her to date. And my sponsor said, "Well, you're going to do whatever you're going to do anyway, so go ahead." And we dated for a couple months, and then we broke up, and then my heart was broke. Oh, man. And my heart was so broke, especially because I said, "Well, she's not going to run me off of my meetings." You know, so every day, I mean, the way that I got sober was get up in the morning, go to work, come home, shower, go to a meeting, go to Coco's, you know, have breakfast, dinner afterwards, come home, and do it all over again. For a whole year and a half, that's what I did. I got up, went to work, went to a meeting, went to Denny's, and then went home. I mean, and it worked for me for a while, you know. I mean, but what happened for my case was that I could only stay sober for so long with the fellowship. Somewhere along the line, I had to do a better job of changing the person that I was. And I broke up with this girl, and God, you want to know, miserable existence is to pick up your first blue chip and be completely wanting to kill yourself, you know. And it finally came to a head when I had about 18 months. I was really considering blowing out my brains because I realized that alcohol was not the solution, but I was feeling the same way that I was when I came in the door. You know, I was depressed and I was despairing. I was depressed because my life sucked, and I was despairing because I could never see it changing. And a couple of things, I know now that it was my higher power, happened right about 18 months. I didn't drink, and I kept going to meetings. I did that right. And you know what? Not drinking and going to meetings is a lot of right a lot of days. Bill Roop says that if you don't drink today, you're a winner. That's 51% of it right there. You know, I'm a winner. I'm over the 50% line. The rest of it is a work in progress. So I did that right, at least, and I went to where the message was. And still today, a great part of my higher power is that he speaks through you. You know, I hear God speak to me through you. I hear a lot of crapheads too, but that's beside the point. Myself included. I was about to blow my brains out, sitting there at a meeting. I went to the roundup, and Clancy spoke. This was in the summer of 1984. And what he talked about was, you know, Clancy runs a midnight mission, or did many years ago, out in Southern California. And they serve free meals to alcoholics out there, to about 1,000 to 1,500 alcoholics a day. And he said, you know what, if you ask those people, is alcohol your problem? He said, they'll tell you no. And he said, you know, they're right, because alcohol isn't the problem. Alcoholism is the problem. And then he went on to say, thank God he said it, he said that not drinking has no effect upon alcoholism except to make it worse. And I went, wow, that's, I haven't been drinking, but my alcoholism, not drinking, has made it worse. And about that same time, over at Biscayne, the man who's become my second sponsor, John H., was speaking. And he said, he was talking about sobriety and how it's like a huge buffet, huge smorgasbord. That's an old word for you guys, young people, up for buffet. And he said, you know what, if you just want the appetizers, if you just don't want hangovers and DUIs, you know, and you want to keep your job, you know, just don't drink. That's all right over there. But if you want the rest of the spiritual benefits that the program has to offer, that's where the rest of the steps come in. You know, that's where the promises come true, is by not being the same person. And I heard that, and I asked him to be my sponsor. We went through the steps again. And since that time, I can say I've had some tough times. I've had some sad times, but I haven't ever wanted to blow my brains out again. We went through the steps again, and I began to. Jesus, it's 9:00. I'm here today. I'm sober, and I'm grateful. Happy birthday, Tim. Thanks a lot.
Grady's going to hand out the chips. We got them all laid out here for you right here, buddy.
I'm Grady. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Grady.
And Eddie Meetings, far and wide. The handout colored things that represent time and sobriety. And that is very different than your poker chips. Does anybody have a desire to stop drinking today? $38 for that drink, silver. $90, red. And 6 months, half a year, yellow.
And
9 months, gray.
Are there any AA anniversaries tonight? Blue chip. Okay.
Pam Lurgal, I'm an alcoholic. Steve, thank you so much. I dearly love you. This is 8. You know, I don't really know what to say. I do what people tell me to do now. When I came into the program 8 years ago, I had no desire to get sober. None. I didn't want what y'all had. I didn't want to quit doing what I was doing. I wanted a roof over my head. I wanted somewhere to sleep, and I wanted food. And that's why I went to treatment. And in the process of that, I heard a message. And actually, Steve was one of the first people that I heard the message from. And I listened, and I did it, and I continue to do it when I don't want to do it, and I show up when I don't want to show up, and I do the things that people that did before me did, and that's how I get to stay here, and I have a seat, and I'm grateful for that. Thank you.
Another birthday, 10.
I'm Kim. Kim's birthday. And we met 5 years ago tonight at this meeting. At this time. And he is, you know, it's an amazing story. And we say things like that in AA. It's unbelievable. I mean, and if you know just the top of the wave with Tim, you know, it is an unbelievable story he's here. But sometimes I think, Steve, people that I admire the most in AA are people who have absolutely nothing to hold back. It's all gone. And I don't think you mind me saying that. And I mean, that was nothing to go back to, and he completely immersed himself in this program. And he has every day since then, and he made that decision that night, and that decision has held. And I realized, and I've been there, you know, every day with him, as I should have. It's an amazing story. It is an honor to be his friend. He has benefited this meeting, he has benefited this clubhouse immensely, and he has benefited my life.
Thank you, Tim. And I'm Tim, and I'm addicted to living sober. That's all it is at this point. I love it. And I appreciate you all for being here. And I know it's getting late, so I can't add a whole lot to what's been said tonight. Steve did a hell of a job. Can everybody give Steve a hand? And when I first got sober, Tim asked me to go see a fellow tell a story, and I meant to ask him earlier what his name was. It was over at 8111. He was picking up a 20-year chip. And I'm nowhere close to that. But he started off the story, and he said, at the end of the story, I'm going to tell you what the secret is and why I've been sober for so long. And, I mean, it was an amazing story. But when he got to the end, the punchline was, why does he do it? Because it's fun. He had the best ride. He wasn't going to give it up. And I think that's the way I feel. I want to say that to myself, and I want to say to you. Thank you very much.
You have more blue chips and more anniversaries. Thank God if you didn't drink today.
Still have my white chip, but I carry that every day. We've got AA-related announcements. I can get started, and then if y'all want to fill in the blanks, this Saturday, Gikipaw, is that how you pronounce it? Georgia chapter of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. Cinco de Mayo, May 5th dance, Saturday night, starts at 9 o'clock, right after the 12 and 12 meeting. Awesome meeting. We're still going to be having the 10 o'clock candlelight meeting. We'll make some kind of adjustment, but it's going to be great. Music. Sombreros. Atlanta Roundup's coming up. More information right over here on this display. What else we got?
I'm Tim, I'm not
Tom. Hey, Tim.
In about 5 minutes, we have a big cake. So I'll have that here in just a minute. As long as
you're glad, you're welcome. Oh, fantastic. Also, if you came in late and you missed the baskets, Mike D has got a basket. He will be signing sheets if you haven't given him a sheet also. So I guess we've come to a close. Sorry we ran late. Hope everybody's curfew is going to be all right. If there are no further announcements, I remind you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions ever, reminding us to place principles before personalities. And for those who will, please join hands in the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. On earth as it is in heaven, give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and glory forever and ever. Amen.
We'll all be together on that broad highway.